Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, Creatures of Accident, a new book about evolution in the animal kingdom. Counterfeit drugs, the World Health Organization launches a campaign to eliminate illegal medicines. And in this week's Look at the Natural World, we turn our attention to what's happening at sea. But we begin with the court case against six health workers in Libya. Five Bulgarian nurses and a Palestinian doctor are facing the death penalty. Now, they've been accused of infecting hundreds of Libyan children with the AIDS virus, HIV, and with causing the death of, I think it's 40 children. The six were arrested in 1999, and the Libyan court is expected to pass sentence on them next week. Well, in recent days, the international scientific journal Nature has published evidence that proves pretty conclusively that these health workers could not have been responsible for the AIDS infections. Well, joining me on the line from Paris is a senior reporter with the journal Nature, Declan Butler. He's been following the court case very closely. Declan, briefly, can you bring us up to date on the court case?
We had the initial court trial when they were condemned to death. It was in 2004, remember? And then that was overturned by the Supreme Court back in December 2005, the 25th of December 2005. And the Supreme Court ordered a retrial, which began in May of this year. And since then, there have been about a dozen hearings. And the trial ended on November the 4th. And we're now expecting a verdict on December the 19th. Now, up until now, we've been campaigning that on two things. One is that in the case, they have refused to listen to any scientific evidence. Initial scientific evidence in the first case by Professor Luc Montagnier and Vittorio Colizzi was thrown out. And instead, they listened to a report made by Libyan experts, which went in the prosecution sense. So since around September, what happened was the prosecution announced on the 29th of August that they were going to call again for the death penalty. And it was that point, really, that we started encouraging the scientific community to take up the case.
So what is the evidence that you have been publishing in Nature in recent days and weeks?
One of the first things we did in November, I've got my hands on the actual scientific report that had been used by the Libyan experts and had been formed the central part of the prosecution case. So I sent that out to AIDS experts worldwide to review, and they came up with the conclusion that, in fact, there was nothing in there, that it was completely empty. Now, since then, last week we published a paper by groups in Oxford and Edinburgh, as well as a worldwide team. And what this showed was that the virus, the infection, had actually began at the hospital many years before the nurses even arrived. Now, the way this defined this data was really interesting, because what they had access to were many of the genetic sequences of the viruses from children who are actually being treated in European hospitals. And now the actual RNA, the genetic sequence of these viruses, they were able to compare these with other HIV viruses around the time and other strains. And they came to two conclusions. One was that the actual strain was a very close cousin. It was almost identical to a similar HIV strain from Ghana and another one from Egypt, which would actually point to the kind of natural spread that you would have through migrant workers, etc. But the really interesting thing they did was that HIV as a virus evolves really, really quickly, which means you can use something called a molecular clock to actually estimate from the rate of mutation how quickly it evolved, each strain, each of the different strains they had, each of the different sequences, and work back in time. And using this technique, and these are actually the top research teams in the world in HIV phylogenetics or family trees who did this work, what they found out was that there was no way that the virus could have, the outbreaks could have began after March 1998 when those health workers arrived.
Do you know if the legal teams in Libya are listening to this evidence?
Well, the current court process is finished on the 4th of November, despite protest by the defence team, including Emmanuel Altit, who's based in Paris, who's the head of the international defence team. And they have complained all along that there are two things here. One is that the trial has not been fair by acceptable international legal standards. And secondly, they have complained always that the scientific evidence hasn't been heard. Now, what this has done is clearly this has created quite a large international outcry, and there's been a lot of newspaper headlines over the past few weeks. So whether that will actually play any role in this verdict is very unclear. But what will happen is if they are condemned on the 19th, that would then go to the Supreme Court as their last and ultimate appeal, if you like. And in that case, then the international community could press harder for that scientific evidence to be taken into account this time around.
Is it unusual for a journal like Nature to get involved in a campaign like this?
Scientific organisations as a whole have actually a long history of being involved in human rights cases and also in cases of academic freedom. In this case, there were two things brought us on board. One was that up until the end of August, there was a general feeling in the community that this would be resolved by diplomatic activities. But then the United States had actually re-established diplomatic relations with Libya back in May, and this trial was meant to be part of that basket of negotiations. So we were faced with an area that we had 3 months to the trial and verdict. So given that it was a death penalty case, and also given that it was an eminently scientific case where you actually needed scientific evidence to be heard, we thought this was something the scientific community should be taking an interest in. So we have led a series of articles and editorials and investigative articles into the case, which have resulted in the scientific community becoming more aware, and from there taking on board the case. And itself, we had a month ago 114 Nobel Prize winners wrote a letter in Nature calling exactly for that, a fair trial and for the scientific evidence to be heard.
Okay, well, we'll be looking for the news of that sentence next week. Declan Butler for Nature in Paris, thank you very much. We'll put a link to your blog spot from our own programme website where people will be able to read more about the evidence and the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
But first, the World Health Organization recently launched a major campaign to cut down on counterfeit drugs. Now, these are illegal medicines. They might contain no active ingredient at all, or worse, they could contain something toxic. At best, they're worthless. At worst, they can kill. Well, to tell me more, I'm joined on the line from the World Health Organization headquarters in Switzerland by Dr. Howard Zucker. He's Assistant Director General for the WHO for Health Technology and Pharmaceuticals. But first, we're going to take this report from Terry Flanagan, who investigated the situation in Ireland.
Weight loss drugs, antidepressants, men's health drugs, antibiotics, painkillers, Viagra, all available without a prescription and at a fraction of the normal price. And this offer is available to anyone with an email account. So what's the catch? Joining me now is Dara O'Loughlin of the Irish Pharmaceutical Union. Dara, how widespread is internet shopping for prescribed drugs?
It's difficult to evaluate it, but we know that it's growing year on year. In line with internet trade in every other commodity, the number of people with internet access is growing every year, and the percentage of those who will buy medicines across the internet is growing as well.
But these are counterfeit drugs.
Very often they are. Most of these emails that people will get, and I get them myself and I'm sure you get them, are from illegal organisations that are selling counterfeit drugs. These are not genuine drugs. These are being knocked up in factories, whether it be in China, in Thailand, in the Pacific Islands, or occasionally, and maybe more worryingly, in backstreet laboratories in cities like London and New York.
And what are the dangers to people, to ordinary punters who go out and buy these drugs?
Number one, you could have a genuine health complaint and you're purchasing medicines over the internet that are inappropriate, are not suitable, are not going to treat this complaint, so your complaint goes untreated and can get worse. Or you could take a medicine that you have purchased over the internet that isn't a genuine medicine but that contains some form of poison. In the United States in 2003, there was 200,000 packets of counterfeit cholesterol tablets found in one swoop. That means that 200,000 people were taking tablets that didn't reduce their cholesterol, so that their risk of a heart attack remained the same as it was before they tried taking these tablets.
What percentage of drugs bought in Ireland would you imagine are bought over the internet?
It's very difficult to say. I would imagine because medicines in Ireland are available subsidised in the various state schemes that people with legitimate health complaints probably don't buy them to the same extent. But the lifestyle type drugs, the Viagra, the erectile dysfunction drugs, even the drugs to enhance athletic performance, whether by bulking up muscle and so on, the steroids, these are not always purchased for the correct reasons. And sometimes people who are buying these for lifestyle reasons might be tempted to do it on the internet because they wouldn't be able to get a prescription from a doctor for them.
Well, talking about the doctor, I'm not feeling well. I've got a sore throat. I know I need an antibiotic. I'm supposed to go to the doctor and get a script. That costs me 45, 50 euros. For him to give me a script for an antibiotic that I know that I'll go to the chemist, that I can buy it from the chemist, why not buy it over the internet? Do people think like that?
I imagine some people think like that, but it's very short-term thinking because you're genuinely putting your health at risk. Self-diagnosis is not always correct. People can go on websites and read a list of symptoms and say, oh yeah, that sounds like what I have. I must have that illness. Therefore, I'll click through here and I'll buy that medicine. A woman in Sunderland recently, just earlier this year, went blind because she had diagnosed herself with a complaint over the internet and had purchased tablets to treat it, which subsequently made her blind. A young man of only 24 years of age in London died 3 years ago because he had diagnosed himself with a particular illness and had purchased excessive quantities of medicine to treat his illness, which actually ended up killing him.
What comeback do people have against the likes of that?
Absolutely no comeback. You buy something on a website or from a spam email that has come in. You don't know who you're buying it from. You could be buying it from a criminal gang in China or from a criminal gang in London. What you can be sure of is that you are not getting quality assured medicine. In fact, the Irish Patients Association put it very succinctly when they said you can die from one click of your mouse.
And who buys these drugs? What type of person purchases these drugs over the net?
I imagine that people who would, it's different people for every class of drug, and people who would buy the likes of Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, these are the erectile dysfunction drugs, might be men who are embarrassed to go and see their GP. Maybe they play golf with the GP, they know him socially, they don't want to go and talk about this problem, and they imagine they can deal with it by buying these medicines on the internet. Other people, maybe young men or young people who are playing sports, might be tempted to buy medicines to improve their performance, whether it's steroids to build up muscle, whether it's EPO to enhance their endurance and their stamina. Again, if you don't know what you're buying, you're doing yourself serious damage. Even if you did get the steroids that you thought you had ordered, you're going to do yourself damage to your various organs, your liver, your kidneys, and even psychiatric damage.
Tara Delaney, you're Director of External Affairs here in Pfizer in Ireland. I presume more than most other companies, you would have great concerns with counterfeit drugs because of Viagra.
For us, it's an issue around patient safety. The problem with people actually self-medicating and buying medicines across the internet, which at best are placebo and at worst can cause some serious danger to them, that impacts the integrity of our medicines and ultimately impacts the lives of patients.
And if I go back to the Viagra, because that's the one that's advertised most commonly, I'm sure you've got many emails yourself.
Yeah, although the counterfeit Viagra is being sold in nightclubs and being passed off with the same dealers that are dealing in ecstasy, for example.
Have you any idea of how much counterfeit Viagra is being used or is out there?
It's very difficult to put a figure on that. I mean, there are 40 million men worldwide taking Viagra. The WHO would estimate that about 10% of drugs worldwide are actually counterfeit. So it's very difficult to put a proper percentage on something like that. But to give you an example, out in Canada last year, our security people did a raid on a Hell's Angels outfit, and they found that counterfeit Viagra was being produced in the same place that they were making methamphetamines. So there is a real difficulty and a real problem with the various drugs and active ingredients getting mixed up together in some kind of a concoction that somebody in a nightclub decides that they're going to take, and the results can be disastrous.
Have you come across counterfeit Viagra in Ireland?
Yes, we have. Yeah, we've had a number of cases reported to the police, and they're actively investigating that.
And what would you like to see happen in the future?
We think that there is legislative change needed. In Europe, because of the free trade of medicines, you have a lot of medicines that are bought in one country, repackaged and sold on in another country, and that impacts the traceability of those medicines. So we would like to see new rules in place so that we can track our medicines from the day that they are produced in the manufacturing facilities right to the day that they get to the patient.
That was Terry Flanagan reporting. Now on the line from Geneva is Dr. Howard Zucker for the World Health Organization, which recently launched a campaign to crack down on counterfeit drugs. Howard, are there actually cases when people have died because of counterfeit drugs?
There are cases all around the world, and there are also cases of children dying as a result of medicines which were supposed to be a simple cough syrup ending up having essentially an antifreeze solution in it.
I've heard of that, I think, from Haiti and from India. And
that's correct.
Also cases of fake vaccines where children, in fact, a case in Niger, I think, a meningitis epidemic when over 2,000 children died, which is a huge death toll. Are there ways that science and technology can help in the fight against counterfeit drugs?
Just as the counterfeiters have already figured out some of the technologies out there to copy the medicines, we need to use technology to overcome that problem. There are different systems of barcoding, there's RFID, all these different technologies out there. However, what we need to do is tailor this to the countries themselves. Some countries can't afford some of the high technology solutions. So we have to look at technologies that are more applicable to them.
You mentioned a technology, RFID. What are you talking about there?
That's a radio frequency identification technique, which sort of could track. It's sort of a track and trace technique.
Legally, do we need to be stricter on counterfeit drugs? Because my understanding is that counterfeit drugs are treated just the same as counterfeit T-shirts.
That is correct. We do need to be stricter. And that is part of the whole objective of what we're doing with this International Medical Products Anti-Counterfeiting Task Force. One of our sub-working groups here is on legislation. Now, again, WHO can't write the legislation for all the nations of the world, but what we can do is work with the nations, work with our member states to have them make sure that their laws are stronger. And someone who counterfeits medicines, just like in your report just now, individuals who die as a result of counterfeiting medicines end up being prosecuted to the extent of the law.
The problem does seem to be worst in developing countries, but how big a problem do you think it is in Ireland?
Let me give you a summary of this. In the wealthier nations and in the developed nations, this is probably less than 1%. It's not that big a problem when it comes to routine medicines. However, as we've just heard, the issues when it comes to lifestyle medicines is much greater, and particularly if you're dealing with the internet. In countries which are less developed, where there are emerging economies, now we're talking about 10%, and this is these are estimates. In the former Soviet republics, we go up to 20%. In some of the Latin American and sub-Saharan African countries, we're up in the 30% range. And when it comes to those rogue internet sites, those unauthorized sites, we could be up in the 50% range. So I think it's a spectrum, and I think that it's important to recognize that the WHO has in the past mentioned 10%, but I'm trying to make sure that people understand that this is actually a spectrum.
That figure of 30 to 50% is flabbergasting.
It's unbelievable. Isn't it amazing that the chances of walking into a place to get your medicines in certain parts of, let's say, sub-Saharan Africa, and you have a 1 in 3 chance of getting the wrong medicine?
Okay. In the meantime, of course, buyer beware. Dr. Howard Zucker of the World Health Organization, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, a new book on evolution in the animal kingdom has just been published by a zoologist, Dr. Wallace Arthur, from the National University of Ireland in Galway. It's called Creatures of Accident. It aims to explain how complex organisms can arise from the very simple process of natural selection and evolution. And when Wallace Arthur was in Dublin to talk about his new book, producer Peter Mooney met with him.
In writing this book, you want to stress complexity over diversity. Explain to me first the difference between complexity and diversity in terms of evolution.
That's a very good question. The best way to picture it, the difference that is between complexity and diversity, is to think of a pair of arrows, one arrow pointing up and down, and the other one cutting across it, going from side to side. Now, a lot of evolutionary biology deals with evolution of diversity within a level of complexity. So, for example, if you take the classic case study of Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands, they radiated out and became different, for example, in their beak size, their beak shape, and so on. Now, that's a case, a good example of evolution producing creatures that are different. They're different from each other, but no one of them is any more complex than another. So you can think of that as radiating out in the kind of horizontal dimension. But when you think then about the bigger picture of evolution, there's also a vertical dimension. If you take, for example, where evolution started, it started with bacteria. If you look at where it's got to now, of course it hasn't finished, but right now is all we know about. And it's produced some exceedingly complex creatures, including ourselves. So that's, if you like, the vertical axis of evolution, becoming more and more complex. So evolution has done both things over the course of time. It's made some creatures much more complex than their ancestors, but it's also done a lot of diversifying within a level of complexity. And I really wrote this book because the complexity axis seems to me the philosophically more important of the two, but it's been rather neglected by biologists.
Why is complexity being neglected? Because one would imagine that when people understand Darwin's theory of evolution, they understand it in terms of we started off as some kind of amoeba in some great prehistoric pool, but now here we are doing a radio interview surrounded by complex technology and with ideas that are in our heads that we're transmitting to one another and debating. Do most people not understand evolution as being a process of increasing complexity?
I think at one level they do, actually. But the problem is really twofold. There are, I think, two quite different reasons why complexity, although it's known about, has been downplayed, I'd say, for more than a century in the study of evolution. One reason is that when you want to do an evolutionary study, if you want to make it reasonably in-depth, you have to focus in on a particular group of creatures. I gave the example of Darwin's finches. Once you're looking at a particular, rather narrowly defined group of creatures, it's often the case that none of them are any more complex than any of the others. So that's a kind of a pragmatic reason, that it's just easier to study the diversifying within a level of complexity, the horizontal evolution, than the vertical. But there's another, perhaps even more important reason why complexity has been downplayed. The idea of evolving upwards, in a sense, upwards in complexity, was really from the outset tainted by association with some rather bad ideas. If you go back to around about Darwin's time and a little bit afterwards, there was this old concept of what they call a scala naturae, a natural scale, the idea that you could arrange all creatures in a vertical line with bacteria at the bottom and amoeba down there too, and humans right at the top. And the idea was far too simple. I mean, you can't arrange all creatures in a line. We would now think of a very multiply branched tree with ourselves just on the tip of one twig.
Stephen Jay Gould talked about the bush of life as opposed to the tree of life.
Well, whether it's a bush or a tree, I mean, yeah, you can use either picture. The time around Darwin, both before and after, this idea of a single, almost like a trunk with no branches, an evolutionary trajectory going straight up to humans, a very egocentric view, was dominant. Biologists have not wanted to be associated with that view, and so those of us who are now getting more interested in complexity again have to be very careful to point out that evolution, a lot of the time, leaves complexity unchanged, sometimes makes it go up, but sometimes also makes complexity go down. So pretty much anything can happen.
One of the issues you address in your book is, in a sense, the theological question. And this has been, for generations, Darwin has been accepted as the wisdom of the age. But now there is a huge movement towards intelligent design, and you've addressed this issue in your book. You don't come to the conclusion of Richard Dawkins that an understanding or a belief in Darwin's theories of evolution brings you to a position of atheism. You have said it's agnosticism, but you're still concerned about intelligent design. Just talk to me a little about that.
Sure, yes, the intelligent design movement is an interesting one, because it is effectively the new version of creationism. It's a slightly more clever version, and it's actually harder to argue against it than it is to argue against someone who says that the world began in 4004 BC. So, although there are different shades of intelligent design, like in any movement, what the movement seems to argue for in general is acceptance of evolution, acceptance of a long history of the Earth, acceptance of life starting 3 billion years or so ago in the primordial soup. And so they accept evolution producing, among other things, increasing complexity. They focus indeed a lot on complexity, and they use that as an argument why evolution cannot be a completely natural process. So what they say is that to produce such complex results, the evolutionary process must be guided, if you like, you could even say micromanaged by the hand of an unseen designer. And from a scientific point of view, this is wrong, and it's an attempt to distort the scientific evidence to support what is, in the end, really a faith-based view, as opposed to a testable view, which in science we put a lot of store on testability. Intelligent design is not testable.
Wallace Arthur, thank you very much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And Wallace Arthur's new book, Creatures of Accident, is published by Hill and Wang, and the cover price is $25. Now, time for our weekly look at the natural world. And this week we turn the spotlight on what's happening at sea. And on the line from Dunleary is oceanographer Charlotte O'Kelly of TechWorks Marine, a company that sells monitoring devices that let fish farmers and local authorities keep an eye on water and environmental conditions at sea. Charlotte, more than anyone else in Ireland, you must know what's happening at sea these days. What are conditions like now that winter has arrived?
Conditions at the moment are rather stormy due to all the low pressures that we've had coming overhead. At the moment, we've had waves on the west coast of up to 10 metres swell, water temperatures down to about 9-10 degrees, both on the east and west coast, which is quite cold for this time of the year, and which is also possibly related to the fact that we've had a lot of rainfall going into the sea in very coastal areas. So all in all, not a nice time to be out at sea at the moment.
Gosh, no. 9-10 degrees, you say. What would you normally expect at this time of the year?
Well, this time last year was a tiny bit warmer. The west coast is generally slightly warmer than the east coast, which isn't the case right now in very coastal waters. I would expect it maybe to be 10-11 degrees closer to the coast. Although if you look at the offshore weather buoys at the moment, they are reading 12 degrees further out into the Atlantic. Very coastal data is coming in at just under 9 degrees at the moment, centigrade.
9 degrees cold for anyone planning a Christmas swim.
Rather cold.
Is there much happening in the sea at this time of year? I mean, I'm presuming that it's too cold for something like a plankton bloom.
It is too cold for a plankton bloom. At the moment, what's happening in the sea really is mixing. So the sea is becoming fully mixed. The Irish Sea gets stratified, for example, in summer due to the warmer, calmer conditions we have. So the warmer on the surface is always warmer than the water belowhand. At the moment, it's nicely well mixed. And as a result, the water looks quite murky everywhere. The main thing that's been happening at the moment is quite a lot of big wave activity everywhere. Some of our systems on fish farms have been submerged in recent times, which is quite unheard of for us. So just nasty weather out there, really. The 120 kilometre-hour winds haven't helped with wave activity, so everything's just getting properly churned up. And it's set to last like that for the foreseeable few months anyhow.
Okay, so a wild time at sea.
Wild.
Charlotte O'Kelly, thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our programme website, as always. That's rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you'd like to contact the programme, drop us an email to quantum@rte.ie. Until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte.